We'll begin with a moment of silence to transition into our time together. So good to be with you all. So this week, the last two weeks, we've worked with loving kindness. And often, you know, there are loving kindness courses that are a year long or at least many weeks long. And this is just a little tiny dipping of the toe into the water. I've mentioned that it took me a long time to connect to this practice. And I have connected to it and find it deeply profound and amazing. And it's something that even in just moments of waiting at a stop sign or to just bring phrases of loving kindness into mind, have an immediate resetting of the nervous system. I've been having a lot of trouble sleeping lately. I've had some back issues going on. And I find in the middle of the night to just, you know, bring someone to mind and practice loving kindness for them really is amazingly helpful in all sorts of other ways. So it's, as I say, it's something I just would encourage you to keep experimenting with. And the first time we did this 3 weeks ago, we worked with loving kindness toward those very closest to us and towards our own selves. Last week, we worked with loving kindness toward the neutral person, the person we don't know well, the postman or the person in front of us in the seat in front of us on a plane, or at least back when we used to fly places. And this week, you know, the expanding circles, the concentric circles of care that are at the heart of loving kindness, the biggest circle is for what's often referred to as the enemy, as the person that you have difficulty with, the person who has hurt you, or the person who you see as perpetrating injustice in the world at large, the person that you may find yourself with feelings of rage or hatred toward. And this is the most difficult, the most complex in its way. And I have to tell you, I wasn't sure I was going to work with this in our group really until I just kept flipping on it. And the reason is because it really is, I feel so very new to it myself and I find it so really difficult. And so I wanted really, but I also find movement within myself around it. And as I say, this is a lifelong practice. And I do want to introduce it. Some of you have a lot of experience with this already. But I'm going to lean very heavily here. I feel I have so little experience with it. So I'll lean on Sharon Salzberg very heavily today, who has been teaching and speaking about and deeply, deeply practicing loving kindness for 40 years. It really, truly is her life's work. You know, to hold someone that you feel is a damaging source in the world in care and kindness, in the first place, it can just feel very saccharine and insincere. I mean, love thy enemy or turn the other cheek. It can feel really dangerous. And it can feel as if we were giving up our own moral connection, our own moral conviction. And Salzburg really talks a lot about how, in fact, it's the opposite of that. And the first story of hers I'd like to start with is she tells a story about Martin Luther King and meeting with someone who had been close to Martin Luther King, and how he had told Martin Luther King, you know, I'm not going to love somebody who doesn't deserve it. And King would just say, no, love everybody. And Salzburg wrote that sometimes when I tell this story about it, how Martin Luther King would say, love everybody, people reply, well, look at what happened to him. He got assassinated. As if this were a case of cause and effect, and King would not have been killed if he hadn't tried to love everyone. But how do we know that? If Martin Luther King had been hateful, vicious, and small-minded, would he have been safer? Would we have been safer? How far would the movement have gotten if he hadn't insisted on meeting hatred with love? And it's that, you know, it really touches on the courage of loving kindness and also the faith. Martin Luther King, famously said that the arc of justice, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And I think sometimes this can almost seem like magical thinking, oh, if we just love everybody, the world will become great. But it's much deeper than that. And it really is practicing this because it is your deepest value without the necessity that it will come to fruition in your own lifetime. Martin Luther King did change the world, and he didn't change the world in his own lifetime. And the world isn't fully changed yet, and it never will be. But this practice moves it even incrementally forward. Salzburg tells, you know, the stories of the practice of this in those incredibly inspiring lives. And she talks about Malala Yousafzai, who I think I'm saying that last name wrong, Yousafzai, or I can't pronounce it correctly. But she was the girl in Pakistan who started when she was 12 years old to blog and to campaign for girls and women's education. And at 15, she was shot by a member of the Taliban who got onto the bus she was riding, asked for her by name, and shot her in the face. And she was not killed. She was taken to England. She made a complete recovery. At 15, because she continued to campaign, she was the youngest recipient ever of the Nobel Prize. And Salzburg writes about her. In 2013, Malala appeared on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart to tell her story. Stewart asked her to describe her reaction when she first learned that the Taliban wanted her dead. She replied, "I used to think that the Talib would come and he would just kill me. But then I said, if he comes, what would you do, Malala? Then I would reply to myself, Malala, just take a shoe and hit him. But then I said, if you hit a Talib with your shoe, then there would be no difference between you and the Talib." Despite her young age, Salzburg writes, Malala's wise heart already knew that an eye for an eye retaliation, even with those who sought to harm her, would only hurt her further. When we think, speak, and act from a sense of awareness and compassion, we see that there are many ways to respond to threats and accusations. It's not as though Malala's instinctual reaction to danger was necessarily to be loving and accepting of her attackers, but she had the perspective to recognize that hitting the Talib with her shoe would mean perpetuating the cycle of violence and fear further, playing by the same rules as those who opposed and endangered her. By recognizing that retaliation would both fuel the cycle of violence and cause her to carry the burden of pain, anger, and fear in her own heart, Malala gave herself freedom and courage, reinventing the rules of the game the Taliban tried to play with her. When we allow ourselves to consider the consequences of our actions with a wider lens, we also realize the profound link between how we relate to others and our own sense of harmony and well-being. What is perhaps ironic is that the resolve of Malala's nonviolent emphasis on dialogue and education proved to be more disarming than any violent retaliation. Her goal was not to kill or harm those who were threatening her life as a result of the cause she stood for, but to support the cause regardless of the outcome on her own safety. Her peaceful form of protest showed the Taliban and the rest of the world that her activism had nothing to do with ego, but rather had to do with those who could benefit from her sacrifices. So it's a story that shows how this practice of love can be fiercely powerful. It is a warrior stance. And I think one of the things that's hard about loving kindness practice is our feeling that we're letting others off the hook. You know, if we love somebody who is perpetrating harm, we're letting them off the hook, or it will turn us into patsies. It will make us weak. And again, quoting Salzberg, my great mentor in this, happily, she writes, in 40 years of practicing and teaching loving kindness, I've discovered that instead of turning us into pushovers who lack clear boundaries, this practice makes us stronger, that so that we live more in tune with our deepest values. Loving all others asks us to open our hearts and embrace our shared humanity with people we don't know well or at all. However, it does not require getting personally involved. It does not require us to agree with someone's actions or views, or to confess our love to strangers on the street. It never requires that we sacrifice our principles or cease standing up for what we believe. The primary work is done internally as we cultivate love and compassion in our own hearts. So this can be an extremely private practice. And I think in that way, perhaps it is the most powerful. And I know that for me, really trying during this last election cycle to practice loving kindness. And I know we're a diverse group, and I always hesitate to bring up any sort of politics, but just if this is not your experience with this particular candidate, imagine as I talk, a candidate you do disagree with, but I had a real deep problem with our former president. And so I took him on in my practice to practice loving kindness. And what I found was most helpful for me to begin was to ask this question, to hold him in my view, and to ask this question, where does it hurt? How are you hurting? Why are you hurting? There's an archetype, a Buddhist archetype that's universally powerful, of the hungry ghost. And the hungry ghost, when they're pictured, they're these creatures with tiny, tiny throats and big bloated stomachs. And they can't get enough food through their throat to feed their starving stomach. They're insatiable. And to look at what is it that torments this man in the middle of the night, that he's typing out tweet after tweet in capital letters, and to ask what hurts was helpful to me. And then to imagine him as a child, knowing a little something of his childhood and how painful, how starved he was for love and for approval. And as I would practice, I would feel a softening and an empathy and a compassion, but it certainly didn't change the political decisions I made. If anything, it made me clearer about how I might be effective. Where I really noticed a shift was with my neighbors. And we live in a small community where we were surrounded by Trump flags. And we already knew our neighbors and we liked them and we respected them. So it wasn't that, but what it allowed me to do was to understand the full complexity of somebody's support, that it's part of an entire ecosystem. And it just made it easier for me to feel relaxed or to feel at ease around people who had different political views than I did, to not objectify them in ways that I could see were so damaging when the president was objectifying others. So it created an opening. So let's try a little bit of this loving kindness toward the difficult person.